This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the BBS Radio Network, The People Speak. Yes, folks, it's Ebola Monday again. Here, Rob Kitzel hosting. Tonight, we're very pleased to welcome Deborah Berger. Now, she is with the National Nurses United, a very large nurses union here in the United States. So our foreign viewers can have a look. Please go to the nationalnursesunited.org website, and you can see some of the concerns there that a lot of professional healthcare workers have about Ebola. Anyway, let's get down to it. Let's welcome Deborah Berger. Good evening, Deborah. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having this show.
Well, there's a lot of interest in this topic, and I think that there's a political dimension to this as well, as the implications also for your members, Deborah. And, you know, it's perplexing to a lot of people that flights are still coming into the United States from what would be perceived as Ebola hot zones, when countries like the UK, France, and neighboring African countries have effectively quarantined these certain countries in West Africa where the large outbreaks of Ebola are. And for some reason, we know better. And, you know, it seems to be putting the American public at risk, and it seems to definitely be putting your members at risk. Could you comment on that?
Well, it's such a complex issue. It's really kind of hard to deal with this in a rational manner without having it not touch the edge of politics in this country. And part of what we're concerned about is that if you do put travel bans in place, then it makes it difficult to get the needed supplies, equipment, and personnel to West Africa. And the other thing that we're concerned about is if you make the travel illegal, that meaning that you can't travel from West Africa to the United States, that further drives people that are desperate to get out of that country because of the wars and all of those other issues in those countries. It makes it harder to treat people because they will be less honest about what happens and where they come from. And you have to remember that there aren't any direct flights from West Africa to the United States. They can go through a number of countries. So really trying to screen those people is difficult. And the other issue is when you're having people coming from, say, the U.S. and Canada to West Africa and then want to come back, if you had a travel ban or quarantine, it would make getting volunteers to go to West Africa even harder to recruit.
Well, I understand that, and that's been the position of the administration, but I do think that is rather a straw man argument in the on the administration's part, due to the fact that in the past, and we had C.J. Peters, who's renowned for being able to treat Ebola, he was on 2 weeks ago, and everywhere that we've seen a success with the eradication of Ebola has always involved a quarantine zone. Now, for some reason, we know better, and the CDC, and, you know, I don't think the CDC have instilled a lot of confidence in people. And I also have, looking at what's gone on, according to the Department of Homeland Security and the Immigration Service in the United States, they can catch the origination of anybody. It doesn't matter what airline, whether they come through Brussels or wherever else they come from, they can find out where the people have come from. And, you know, I think this is a big diss to the US military to suggest they are not capable of getting a supply chain through to West Africa. Because when I spoke to Dr. Orient last week, her suggestion was what needs to happen is there needs to be beds, tented areas, lots of IVs, and lots of electrolyte drinks, be it be Lucozade or various other Pedialyte type drinks. And that's what these people need at the moment more than anything, because obviously the debilitating effects of this is people cannot keep fluids in their body. And my understanding is you have a potential of a fighting chance if you can keep hydrated. Is that the case?
That is the case. And you actually need people that can start IVs to get them not only oral hydration, because oftentimes they can do oral hydration in the early stages, but they also need IVs so that as their vomiting and diarrhea worsen and they're unable to keep up with fluids through oral, you also need IVs. And that also requires skill and supplies. But the thing with the CDC guidelines here in the United States is the fact that they're not mandated. So there's over 5,000 hospitals in the United States, and the CDC's most recent guidelines sort of left this cafeteria plan of personal protection for healthcare workers in this country caring for patients with Ebola. And the problem there is that the employers, all these hospitals, 5,000 of them, get to pick and choose which personal protection equipment they want to supply to their employees. And that all is not always based on what's right for the situation. It is usually what's right for the pocketbook.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And you know, just as a personal question, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, because it could be a little bit politically incorrect. Going on about the pocketbook, do you think it's possible that the hospital in Texas did not treat Mr. Duncan, patient one or patient zero, whatever we want to call him, because he didn't have insurance or possibly the financial means to be admitted into the hospital? George, do you just think it was a genuine oversight, or would you just care not to comment?
Well, when we had the press conference with the nurses that came forward anonymously and spoke on our press conference, they said that they did not consider whether he had insurance or not, that didn't come into the sort of the ability to provide care. However, when Mr. Duncan was sent home the first time, he was sent home by one of the hospital-based specialist doctors, and their consideration, because they're partners in Texas Health Resources, is affected by the bottom line. So if they choose to provide care for a patient that doesn't have insurance, then that only reinforces the fact that they are partners in this Texas Healthcare Resources group, right? And if they provide care for somebody that can't afford it, that goes into their affects their bottom line.
Yeah, I suspected something on those lines, and you know, I wouldn't think like the admission nurse or somebody would, but there are, you know, financial gatekeepers in these large medical institutions now, as we all know. It's part of life, I must say. They're very interested in getting everything from your full details, a copy of your driving license, and your inside leg measurement, if they'll let you have it. You know, that's pretty much what they're all about, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I think they almost want to put an RFID chip on you until you've paid them.
Well, in the United States, they are actually starting to charge up front for various surgeries and things. So if you have any co-pays from $50 to $1,000 before you can actually be scheduled for your surgery, they want the money up front. So it's not unusual in this country, which is really sad.
Yes, no, I am very familiar. Well, we have a caller on the line now, and this is one of those people who didn't tell us their name, actually. So they're going by the name Radical Moderate from Illinois. Radical Moderate, you're on with Deborah Berger of the Nurses United. Over to Radical Moderate, Don, please.
Thank you very much. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, let me just say how great it is what Western healthcare workers are doing in Africa. You guys are real heroes in my book for doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Much welcome. My question has a few points. The first is, I'm sure you're aware, historically speaking, as at least I understand it, that the first major outbreak of Ebola was spread primarily through the healthcare workers who contracted it and spread it to their patients. Now, I understand that this was due to not knowing what it was and the unsanitary conditions at the time of the 1970s. However, even with the state-of-the-art biohazard equipment and the procedures that I have seen from news reports, even with these procedures in place, a few doctors and nurses have still come down with the disease. With this in mind, is it really too much to ask? Is it really an inconvenience to those returning from these, well, basically hell holes, to be in isolation for 21 days or however long it is?
Well, there you get into the difficulties in trying to deal with this, because you have somebody that's essentially volunteering, giving up their pay for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, and then you're asking them then to come back to the United States and give up another 3 weeks without pay. And if you have the proper equipment, and this is what I mean, is that you have no skin exposed, you have somebody supervising you, taking on and off your clothes, you have short periods of time in providing care with the patient, then you're less likely to actually be contaminated. The 2, 3, 4 healthcare workers that came back from West Africa were only a small percentage of those people that were already providing care for people, and so far nobody else has gotten exposed to the Ebola virus, has come down with Ebola as a result of their exposure to these doctors and nurses. The only patient that ended up infecting 2 nurses was at the Dallas hospital. And that's because of their lax procedures.
Okay, well, I understand that. And I don't mean to take up too much of your time. I just like to finish up here. You said the key words there. Even with all these state-of-the-art procedures, even with everything, buddy system, supervisor watching over you, the two-layered gloves and the two-layer suits and everything, even with that, the only thing you can assure us is you're less likely. And the fact that there were, I'm not talking about the nurses in Texas, that was horrible what they did. But even with this in place, you still had several doctors, well, I shouldn't say several doctors and nurses, but a few doctors and nurses, even following these procedures, contract the disease. Now, mind you, I've heard that they say, well, you only become contagious when you're symptomatic. Okay, that assumes that as soon as you got the fever, you're symptomatic. But what if you just get these symptoms, you kind of ignore them a little bit, or you're symptomatic an hour before you develop a fever? Okay, I mean, you can't really nail it down to actually when, bam, you're symptomatic, okay? So let's say these doctors and nurses, they go into an unsecure location in their hospitals, in their doctor's office, where they're working on sick people to begin with, so their immune systems are compromised. I mean, seriously, I think it is just too much of a risk to take this risk that they could totally transmit it unwillingly, like it was transmitted when it first broke out in Africa, you know? Mm-hmm. And I understand the position of where you know, hey, well, that was just an added inconvenience. Are the doctors and nurses now going to want to go and donate their time for even longer to spend in quarantine? Well, you know what? Again, my opinion on these doctors and nurses, like I said, they're the real heroes. I don't think it's too much to ask that they're already have done the unthinkable, in my mind, going into these hot zones deliberately. I don't think it's too much to ask and too much of an inconvenience to extend that for an extra 21 days for the safety of the public. And that's pretty much it. I'm going to get off my soapbox. I'm going to go back to listen. I'm going to go off the line and listen to your response through Pal Talk. Thank you very much for your time. And again, thank you so much for the work you guys do. Really is appreciated.
You're welcome. So the thing is that it is an extremely complex issue. And the research that we currently understand is that somebody that is exposed to Ebola virus and comes down with Ebola, with the disease, they only become contagious when they become symptomatic. And the first symptom is generally an elevated body temperature, right? There may be body aches, there may be vomiting or diarrhea, but these people that have come back generally are monitoring their symptoms, and they're also having now the public health department and the CDC monitoring. So they're not left up to their own sort of honorary check-in system, which I didn't really think was a good idea, because essentially they have been under stress for the whatever time they were in that country, actually listening to, you know, seeing all of this horror, right? So they're sort of post-traumatic stress, right? The way that you then care for them as patients is to monitor them and track them and make sure that they're following the guidelines. Now, it may come down to the fact that we do have to quarantine, but I think it's better to have a rational discussion about what happens rather than worry without actually listening to the science.
Yeah, I think that's a position that a lot of people have stated. I just think that a lot of the public just are probably a bit like our caller. You know, they're not particularly buying it. It's, you know, obviously people can feel empathy for medical professionals that are inconvenienced. But when you have a situation like we had the doctor who's roaming around the one of the most major cities on the planet, going on various trains, going to bowling alleys, it is a bit of a problem. Anyway, we have another caller on the line. This is Jesse. He's calling from Arkansas. Jesse from Arkansas, you're through to Deborah Berg. Sorry about that. I flubbed that. Deborah Berger of National Nurses United. Your question, please, Jesse.
Hello, Ms. Berger. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
My question is this. Given this attitude that seems kind of laissez-faire about all of a sudden the creation of, you know, what you describe as a cafeteria-like attitude towards Ebola, what would be the procedure that you've been instructed to carry out should you end up with something like a pandemic in your area? In other words, who would you call? Let's say you had 10, 20, 40 people that showed up and they appeared to be symptomatic of Ebola. Who then do you call? Have there been any instructions from the CDC or even the DHS as to what you would do next?
Well, the thing is, it's not likely that there's going to be 20 or 30 people showing up. This was the one patient in Dallas, the two or three doctors and a nurse that came back that were actually involved in patient care. We know now that we're to call the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the Public Health Department in the area. But what the nurses have said all along is that the 5,000 hospital healthcare facilities in the U.S. up until just last week were really not taking this seriously enough. And we have Dallas to point to as the example of facilities not being ready. The nurses admit, even on 60 Minutes, that they were having to train the nurses about what to wear and how to handle the patient when they came in to get report and take care of Mr. Duncan. And so we have been advocating for over 2 months now, almost three, to make sure that the nurses are educated and trained and have the proper equipment. Now, it turns out that Mr. Duncan's family was concerned enough, and they were the ones that called the CDC and the Public Health Department, right? It wasn't the hospital that called. So what we're concerned about is that everybody on the healthcare team really needs to know what to do when somebody presents to the hospital that is a potential Ebola patient. And the other thing is, as I said before, the CDC can make guidelines, but until either Congress or the president mandate mandatory standards for optimal personal protection and how you handle these patients, it's still going to be spotty.
Okay, so, and at this point, there is no procedure then, other than, basically protect yourself as a nurse.
Well,
there really is no procedure.
Well, actually, the CDC did change the guidelines, and they have teams that are supposed to be organized to go out to where a potential patient, like that doctor in New York, the CDC was there within 6 hours. But our point gets back to the fact that that's a good step in the right direction, but for those first 6 hours, everybody needs to be educated on how to deal with those patients, and that is still not being implemented, and it can't be implemented by the CDC because they don't have any regulatory authority or ability to penalize or fine these hospitals for not following the guidelines. That's the problem.
Okay, well, I was just wondering, given the fact we now have an Ebola czar, you know what I mean, whether or not there would be at least some uniform procedure there.
Well,
following.
But that gets back to the regulatory authority. He's an Ebola czar, and he can get all these departments to actually work together. But he does not have any regulatory authority either. It takes an act of Congress, bipartisan, both Republicans and Democrats, to come together to give the CDC the authority they would need to mandate the guidelines.
Okay,
well, good.
I guess I have one last question, and I'll go. But what would you do as a nurse to protect yourself in this, what really is a confusing situation?
Well, if you went on our website, National Nurses United, we actually have the specific hazmat suit the specific respirator that's needed so that you leave no skin exposed, that all of the seams for the garments are sealed, and it's one continuous suit, so there is no possibility of leakage of bodily fluids from the patient onto the healthcare worker that's providing the care.
Thank you, ma'am.
Excellent. Well, thank you for calling in, Jesse. Okay, now on line two, we will take one more before the break. We have Dee calling from New Jersey. Dee from New Jersey, you're on with Deborah Berger. Your question, please.
Hi, Deborah. It's Dave from New Jersey.
Hi.
My question is, how do we know that the attempt to cure patients in West Africa by sending in armies of, you know, medical workers isn't the very mechanism that helps the Ebola virus spread out of West Africa and in into different we'll call them ecosystems or microclimates with different microbial life forms, that there where Ebola may take off, you know, and spread in ways that we haven't understood. If we're bringing Ebola into other environments like the New York City subway system.
Okay. Well, the military's role, as I understood it from the hearing that I was at on just this last Friday, there was a congressional hearing. The military's role is a supportive one only in that they are building isolation hospitals, just the bare bones, not like cement walls and the whole thing, but they are building in the communities essentially Ebola care centers, right? And their directive from their military commanders is that they are not to come in contact with the community at large. They have their own mess.
Yeah, I'm not just talking about the military. It's a broader question. I'm talking about the whole attempt at curing Ebola patients in West Africa exposes medical workers to Ebola. And they travel back and possibly bring back the virus, like what happened in New York, into different microclimates, into different ecosystems. Different
you're talking about mutations, right?
Not just mutations. Ebola has never been tested in a subway system with different temperatures and different microbes. How do we know it doesn't flourish in these environments that we're now introducing it to, like various other life forms have, like when we introduce a life form from other environments into different ecosystems, they tend not to have natural predators. When we introduce Ebola into other environments besides West Africa, how do we know we're not introducing it into an environment where it might flourish in ways it doesn't flourish in West Africa?
Well, it's actually in the body that it flourishes at 98.6, right?
It also flourishes in microbial life. That's why it lives on surfaces. So how do we know we're not
It only lives on the surface, generally speaking, in fluid. So it has to be a wet surface. It dies relatively quickly, within an hour or so, from on a dry surface. Now, you do have a good point that there can
subway systems are damp. They're covered with microbial life. Mm-hmm. How do we know that we're not taking Ebola out of West Africa and introducing it into brand new environments where the CDC has absolutely no idea what will happen, but they're willing to put us at risk anyway?
Well, what we know right now, and I can't speculate about what would happen in a subway system, because all I know is that currently the virus needs a human host or an animal host to survive, right? And if you're talking about mutation, that's another issue. But so far it is not shown to be mutating in any other way, and the virus still needs a human host or the animal host to replicate because of the various proteins that they need to support their existence.
I disagree with that assessment.
Well, you can. I mean, you can, because I'm certainly not an expert.
Well, the tests, the latest test shows it can live in colder environments in mucus for up to, I think, up to 2 weeks, which proves it's consuming something in the mucus, mm-hmm. which is microbial life.
Mm-hmm.
So the assessment of the CDC that they're telling you can only live in humans is wrong, because
mm-hmm.
that's not what viruses do.
Then you're obviously more of an expert than I am, so, you know, I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, on that, I think we will take a quick break. Thank you very much, Dave from New Jersey, a very combative caller tonight. And I think you can see here, Deborah, that people are very passionate about this. And, you know, this man lives just outside New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's very unhappy that, you know, he feels like, you know, his state's been put at risk, you know, by, you know, basically reckless actions by this administration. I personally don't think they're taking it seriously enough either. You know, for the UK to stop it, and the UK generally will be doing anything, you know, not to cause an issue like this at Heathrow, for them to stop flights going into Heathrow, you would have to say that they had some very serious concerns. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we will take a break now. Regroup. Don, can you put us through to the break? Thank you very much. We'll be back shortly with the People Speak.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please. Give to the World Food Program.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak, the BBS radio network. Please call in at 1-888-429-5471. That's toll free in the United States and Canada. And if you're outside the United States and Canada, you can reach us on area code 530-763-1594. We're back with Deborah Berger of National Nurses United. Deborah, obviously, we had a passionate caller, Dave from New Jersey there. You know, he feels extremely strongly about that these flights are still being allowed into the country. And today I noticed that Governor Christie, who had quarantined the nurse that had come back from West Africa in like a little tented area, apparently she was going to sue, I think, the governor over civil rights violations or something. And I believe she has been allowed out of the quarantine area. And has she been allowed to go home and be quarantined there? What do you know about this?
What I did know is that the tented area that she was quarantined in was not heated. It wasn't like a place where you could actually relax and feel comfortable being in that area. The other thing was that she was released to go to her home and report in twice a day to the public health department. So she's essentially being quarantined in her own home.
Okay. Well, that probably makes sense anyway. I have a question text to me, and this is Jane, who is an RN from Australia. And her question is, are nurses formally advised by Washington in terms of policy or on banning travel, etc.? Or is it just doctors that have that kind of political clout?
I guess I don't understand the question. It says, are nurses advised on travel to West Africa?
Yeah, I think the point is that, you know, is there a travel advisory to nurses or is it all medical staff? My feelings may be what yours are, is that the goalposts keep moving because of, you know, things that have been going on. And probably when people initially went, there wasn't probably as much advice as there is now or rules as there is now. Is that true?
That is the problem. And this is where the politics sort of starts coming in. Is that when people initially went to through, I think it's Samaritan's Purse, and the CDC even sent people in, other organizations like Doctors Without Borders and Partners in Health sent people in, there was the assumption that they wouldn't, if they followed the protocols, wouldn't end up getting Ebola. They came back home. There wasn't the quarantine sort of discussion. People just silently came back. They monitored their themselves, and it wasn't until Mr. Duncan became a patient. And then spread it to two nurses that a number of groups started getting extremely concerned because it appeared that Ebola was easier to catch than was initially thought. And there, it wasn't taken into consideration that that hospital wasn't supplying the equipment the nurses and other healthcare workers needed in order to safely take care of Mr. Duncan. So that's part of where this furor has started coming out, because it looked like it was easier to get Ebola than it really is.
Okay, that seems reasonable. Now, we have a call, well, it's not a call actually, I've got a text from Christina from Germany, and her question is really, well, it's actually a few questions, but basically she's saying, don't nurses and doctors join Doctors Without Borders and other organizations to look good for the hospitals they're working for and to pad out the resumes that they have? Your thoughts on that question?
That's an interesting question. I can't say what the motives are for people that go on these medical missions. Some hospitals actually sponsor medical missions, and they do bring back good publicity and PR for their hospitals. However, our organization, RNRN, Registered Nurse Response Network, has sent nurses into certain disaster areas. The last one that I was in Haiti, and it was really to provide relief and respite for the nurses that were there that were also victims of the earthquake. So we helped to, you know, provide care for them, and it certainly didn't build up my resume, and it didn't get publicity for my hospital because I didn't go from my hospital. I went from my organization. But I do see connection between a motive of wanting to spiff up a hospital's reputation. But I know Samaritan's Purse was a religious group that went there, and Doctors Without Borders and Partners in Health do a lot of work in a lot of countries, and they're not necessarily linked to hospitals.
Yeah. What do you think about the mortality rate as well that some of the healthcare workers with Doctors Without Borders have had with this Ebola incident? I've heard conflicting reports on how many casualties they've had, and it seems like a large number. I don't know what numbers you've heard. I've had conflicting numbers from various people, but
what I've heard is it ranges anywhere between 50% and 70% of healthcare workers as a category, right? And in Liberia, person that was speaking, the spokesperson from Liberia, clearly said that they refer to Ebola as the nurse killer disease, and that's because when you're in such close contact with the body secretions, you know, the vomiting, the diarrhea, the all of the mucus, the blood, all of those things, those are what actually transmit the disease from one person to another. So having the personal protections is key. And it also depends on whether your body is immunocompromised or if you've picked up the symptoms early. So if you're sort of denying that you're having fever, body aches, vomiting, diarrhea, whatever, and delay treatment, then that also then delays the success of how well you fight that disease. Mr. Duncan is a perfect example. If they had kept him and started and tested him and started treatment when he first came into the hospital, he probably would have survived.
Yeah, well, let's not tell Jesse Jackson that. But anyway, I think he's already involved. But yeah, that's probably going to be the source of some litigation by the look of it, from like what we were talking about earlier. And it is a sad state of affairs when something like that happens, albeit that he wasn't truthful on his application to enter the country in the first place.
Well, but I thought on his application he did say he was from West Africa. That when the nurse took him in the first time, he actually said he was from Africa. So in those two instances, he told the truth, right? The other thing that was interesting was that there's many other diseases in Africa that mimic Ebola, malaria, dengue fever, and a whole host of other diseases. And when he was carrying that woman into the hospital and they turned her around and sent her home, he didn't at that time know she died from Ebola.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's been the bone of contention with some people. When he was asked at the airport, had he had any, you know, contact with somebody, mm-hmm. You know, and who knows? We get a lot of this information secondhand, and mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of people would rather err on the side of caution and just, mm-hmm. you know, shut everything down and mm-hmm. make sure people have a quarantine before they come out of the area. Kind of like what C.J. Peters and his team had done when they were doing things before. And the other interesting one is the people in Nigeria, in Lagos. I don't know if you've heard that story from there. And this was absolutely horrific. They had a patient there in the hospital, and he became violent with them and said he was leaving. And the doctor, who was a lady doctor, had her three staff with her. And this was a larger man, probably about 240 pounds, something like that. He tried to leave. And in doing so, they restrained him somehow. And all four of them, because of the contact with him, contracted Ebola. And all four of them died. But the doctor said, he is not leaving this hospital. He cannot be allowed on the streets of Lagos. And really, she and the other healthcare workers are like really national heroes, because if somebody like him was that infectious and went out onto the streets of Lagos, there's no telling the damage somebody like that could have done.
Well, that is heroic. And it's unfortunate that that had to happen. But they could have, and, you know, this is second-guessing how somebody would handle the situation. They could have sent him out, let him go wherever he was going to go, and had security follow him to make sure that he didn't come in contact with people. But, you know, it's really a bad situation. I don't think there's any way of winning that.
No, there isn't, I don't think. And, you know, I think a lot of people also feel like that, you know, with other African countries, I think now, like Nigeria and other African countries in the area that don't have, I think Equatorial Guinea as well, that don't have Ebola, they've effectively closed off their borders.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to be almost like doublespeak from the administration here, where they're almost not wanting healthcare workers in the States to be deterred from going over there, even though it seems extremely risky for one to go over there. And, you know, what percentage, I know it's probably impossible for you to say, but what sort of percentage of your members, and you've got a lot of members, what have you got, 180,000 members, what percentage of your members do you think would go on something like this? I mean, obviously, people are very passionate that are involved in nursing, but you know, this goes beyond passion. This is where you're possibly having a 1 in 5, 1 in 10 chance of contracting Ebola, and then we know what the odds are on that. I mean, it's got to be very frightening, hasn't it, for anybody to risk doing something like this?
Right, and our organization, the RNRN organization, where we do send nurses into disaster areas, is really not prepared to deal with the kind of logistics and uncertainties in providing care for people in West Africa. We don't have the resources because our ability to provide disaster relief is based on donations. And we generally don't send nurses into a situation that would make the situation worse, meaning we don't really have the network to go into a hospital situation and provide care and be on our own. When we were in Haiti, We used another hospital group that actually provided security and the ability to provide care in that community without making us a burden on that group. In West Africa, there isn't any support group that we could really utilize at this point to get the nurses there, as well as providing the support for the nurses. So nurses can volunteer through Doctors Without Borders and Partners in Health, but we haven't had any plans to do that yet. We have sent over 1,000 hazmat suits and a generator for the nurses group in Liberia, as well as laptop computers. But at this point, sending people in isn't practical.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it is. When you were in Haiti, was the cholera epidemic going on, or were you there before that?
No, I was there before that. I was there about 2 to 3 weeks after the earthquake. And we were working with a group up in Cap Haitien in Milo. There was a smaller hospital there that they turned into like a surgery center, and it sort of expanded operations to accommodate earthquake people, victims, and set up a tent city in one of the soccer fields. So there were like 3 or 4 large, almost warehouse-sized tents to provide care. Yeah, it was a totally different situation.
Yes, it was. And as bad as Haiti was, it probably isn't anywhere near as bad as what's going on in West Africa. Anyway, I hope we have another caller on the line. Don, do we have another caller on the line? I think you may have somebody on line one. Apparently, he doesn't. He had somebody on and he's lost them. So we'll have another question from somebody else.
Okay.
Where do we go from here? What do you think is going to happen now?
Really happy that the Obama administration did send in the military and some of the National Guard and the various state national reserves to help build infrastructure in West Africa, in Liberia. Because they were severely lacking in the ability to have beds for these patients to, you know, even lay on and get treatment and be isolated so that there were true isolation rooms, so you're not exposing people that have diarrhea and fevers from one disease and exposing them actually to Ebola while you're trying to rule out which disease it really is. They also got lab equipment in there so that they could diagnose Ebola within hours instead of the days that it would take, and sometimes over a week. So having that kind of support is going to make a difference. But in reality, there is no country that is giving what they really should as a percentage of their ability to give to the countries in West Africa that need help. We've been, all of us as internationally, have really not stepped up to the plate to hold our governments accountable to help the West African countries fight this epidemic. They need more money and support and actually personnel.
Yeah, I think personnel is the key, and probably it's very difficult to achieve, as you said. Okay, our caller is back. We have John calling us from Canada. John, your question, please, for Deborah Berger.
Good evening, Deborah. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Good. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I was absolutely outraged as a non-medical person To hear Tom Frieden say that the hospital across America were well equipped to deal with Ebola. And then I listened to the nurses' conference nationwide, and I heard the voices and opinions from the boots on the ground saying we don't have the equipment we need to deal with this properly. This outbreak is, you know, 10 times the size of the other outbreaks. I have two questions for you. One is, do you, and I'm sorry if this is redundant, I got here a little late, do you think the hospitals across America are properly equipped to deal with this strain of Ebola? And it was suggested that if you are in close contact, you nurses, you need respirators, not masks. And secondly, do you have any opinion on why the West was so slow to respond to this outbreak when Doctors Without Borders was screaming last March that they needed help?
Those are some tall orders to respond to. It was disappointing that globally the governments were responding way too slowly to this outbreak, and I think what finally woke some people up was the alert that both the United Nations and the World Health Organization put out in August, saying, if you don't help us, there's going to be an international pandemic, and it's going to get away from us if you don't do something now. That sort of got people out of this daze in thinking that West Africa could fight this on their own. It's still a little bit too late. You know, it's too little too late at this point. They do need to step up their ability to help these countries, because these are the poorest of the poor countries. Some of them have had continual civil war, and that has affected the ability for these people to get treatment. And the fact that our nurses here in this country have for 3 months now sent
Deborah, I hate to break in, but Don is telling me we have to close because of time constraints, because another show follows ours. But thank you very much. It's been very, very informative. And everybody, if they can take a look at the National Nurses United website, nationalnursesunited.org, there's some petitions on there that people can sign and have a look at. And you can see the equipment that nurses are looking at. And you know, people, as you can see, are very passionate about this subject. We really thank you for coming on to this People Speak, and hopefully we can have you back again. I'm hoping this epidemic will pass us quickly, but it seems like it's reached proportions that it probably isn't going to go away too soon. But we certainly thank you for all you've done, and good luck to you and all your members, because I know people appreciate the good work you're doing.
Thank you very much for having this special. It really does, I think, help spread information and readiness instead of fear.
Good. This is Rob Kitzel signing off for the People Speak. Have a good week, everybody. Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.